I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Testifying yesterday before the January 6th committee, retired Judge Michael Luttig said, quote, "I would have laid my body across the road before I would let the vice president overturn the results of the 2020 election." Luttig was one of several witnesses on Thursday who described then-President Trump's relentless campaign to pressure his vice president, Mike Pence, to refuse to certify the results of the election, including egging on the mob who were threatening to kill Pence, who was hiding in the Capitol. 50 years ago today, June 17, 1972, burglars who were working for former President Nixon's re-election campaign broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate complex intent on installing listening devices. As we know now, they were arrested. There were Senate hearings through much of the summer of 1973, followed by Nixon's resignation. Garrett Graff's new book, Watergate, A New History, is based on the extensive archival record of this political scandal. He says Watergate was not an aberration for Nixon, rather the end result of years of dirty tricks, corruption, scandals, and lies. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about both what's happening now and what happened 50 years ago. He is director of cyber initiatives for the Aspen Institute. Garrett Graff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
What a week to talk.
I was going to say, where do we begin? I actually would like to begin with yesterday's testimony, and I quoted from Michael Luttig. But just to underscore, even though some of it was very legalistic and not the most, you know, exciting delivery, nonetheless, we have a former president, Donald Trump, essentially putting his vice president's life at risk. Can you respond to that?
Yesterday was, I think, one of the most remarkable congressional hearings we've ever seen in our nation's history. At one level, it was, bizarre to even see an entire hearing dedicated to debunking the clearly commonsensically wrong idea that the vice president of the United States even has a role to personally overturn the election results if he or she chooses during the certification process. But more than that, though, as you said, it's this incredible moment to reckon with how much pressure Vice President Pence was under in the days leading up to January 6th from President Trump. And that President Trump, as January 6th was unfolding, was willing to raise the stakes, raise the pressure, and, put Vice President Pence's life at stake. And I think one of the things as a country that we have not yet reckoned with is how close we came that day to actual disaster, both in terms of a constitutional crisis and the assault on the vice president's own life.
Well, there were gallows outside, and apparently we learned yesterday, and I think maybe some of Pence's people learned yesterday, that there was about 40 feet or so between them hiding in the Capitol and this mob.
Exactly. And that this was a mob that the president incited and encouraged to assault the vice president, even as he learned of the attack on the Capitol. One of the things that became clear in the hearing yesterday was the way that the president encouraged the targeting of Mike Pence, even once he understood that the assault was underway at the Capitol.
Here's another quote from Michael Luttig from yesterday. He said, "Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy, not just what happened on January 6th, but as we look ahead to 2024 and the presidential election." Do you see it that way?
I do. And I think he spoke very clearly and eloquently and solemnly to that. Part of what is clear in hindsight about January 6th is that one of the reasons that January 6th and the president's attempts to overturn the election failed was because they didn't plan early enough. and that we are very clearly seeing signs at the local and state level of GOP candidates effectively running on a platform of, don't worry, we will be happy to overturn the next election.
You mentioned John Eastman. He was a lawyer who was pressuring Pence along with Trump, Trump pressuring Pence to essentially overturn the results of the election. This was this idea, as you said, that he came up with. It doesn't obviously hold up constitutionally, but he also said, and this is Eastman, I've decided I should be on the pardon list if that's still in the works. Sort of trying to have it both ways, to put it mildly.
Yes, and I think that one of the things that really stood out to me in yesterday's hearing was just how isolated the president was in those weeks after the election. That senior aides to him, senior aides to the vice president, were clearly telling the president that what he was doing was wrong, that there was no basis for it, that there was no basis for the fraud allegations. His campaign was saying that, the White House was saying that, and that he persisted. And one of the questions that clearly the January 6th committee is wrestling with, and presumably the Justice Department is wrestling with, right, is they're setting up a lot of the predicates for a fraud and conspiracy case against the president, because he was being told what he was doing was wrong. He was being told what he was doing had no basis in fact. And he was being told that what he was doing was illegal. And so for him to continue and to continue relying on the advice of people like John Eastman, who also was evidently in yesterday's hearing, we learned himself didn't believe that there was a constitutional basis for the argument that he was putting forward, and that Eastman himself admitted that it was a case that would be lost 9-0 at the U.S. Supreme Court if it ever went there. It is really remarkable.
Well, let me quote you a tweet that you tweeted out earlier this week. Watergate, as we have come to understand, was not just a burglary on June 17th, 1972, but an umbrella of about a dozen interrelated but distinct scandals, all of which emerged from the dark, paranoid, conspiratorial and criminal psyche of Richard Nixon that he brought to the White House and permeated his administration. Then you go on to say, and I think that's very similar to what we saw with President Trump. Flesh that out for us.
Yeah. So one of the things that becomes clear in Watergate, and this was really one of the things that I tried to set out to do in writing my history now, a half century after the fact, is that Watergate wasn't a burglary. It was a mindset, and that it was this dark, criminal, paranoid, conspiratorial thread that runs throughout Richard Nixon's political life, his campaigns, and then ultimately the White House. And that one of the things that we now understand is that Watergate was in some ways, the Watergate burglary was a continuation of a bunch of forces that had been underway already in his administration. It wasn't a one-off third-rate burglary. It was part of this umbrella of about a dozen interrelated scandals. And that what I think that understanding is important to our understanding also of the Trump administration, which is as we're beginning to get some sense of the history. And you know, looking at it less as current events and more as history, is that there is a very single and similar dark criminal, paranoid, conspiratorial mindset that Donald Trump brings to the presidency that unfolds in a pretty straight line from the Russian attack on the 2016 election through the Mueller investigation, the president's attempts to obstruct justice there, his you know, so-called perfect telephone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky basically the morning after the Mueller investigation wraps up, which leads then to the first impeachment translating and evolving into his big lies and attempt to undermine the legitimacy of the 2020 election, which leads to January 6th, which leads to the second impeachment. That sort of Donald Trump is all one story in the same way that Richard Nixon's Watergate all turns out to be one story.
And I wonder whether even predating Trump's time in office, how many harassment lawsuits is he facing? There were vendors that he didn't pay, you know, when he was a real estate developer, his use, misuse of the tax code. And I think until Watergate, you know, Nixon got away with his dirty tricks. And I think it's also true for Donald Trump so far anyway.
Exactly. And that, you know, the January 6th was hardly a runoff, or sorry, hardly a one-off. It was, in fact, something that was part and parcel of the entire way that he viewed the world.
I also think it's really weird that you've got Roger Stone, who has Nixon's tattoo on his back, who was, you know, part of his fan base. There he shows up, you know, under Donald Trump.
Yes, and Roger Stone, of course, really gets his start in politics in the Richard Nixon dirty tricks operation in the 72 campaign.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, to compare the hearings. And I didn't realize in your book, you said there were 237 hours of hearings back in the summer of 1973. I remember listening to them. I was a young adult at the time. I did the math. That's something like 30 days of hearing. They began relatively early in the morning. They went through, you know, most of the day. I think PBS rebroadcast them in the evenings. And today, it's a much more sort of truncated set of hearings that we are hopefully tuning into here. How do you compare and contrast?
It is hard to capture now, 50 years after a fact, just how revolutionary those Watergate hearings were from Sam Ervin's Watergate Select Committee in the summer of 1973. As you said, they carried about 11 weeks of hearings that summer, 237 hours broadcast across the three major networks, and then, as you said, re-aired on PBS in primetime. About 80% of America watched those hearings, and the average American household watched about 30 hours of hearings. I mean, that's nearly a full works week worth of hearings over the course of the 11-week summer, you know, an unprecedented and amazing level of civic engagement and involvement. And I think that it captivated the country and really drove and changed the way that we had been looking at the Watergate scandal at the time. And I think I do worry that the January 6th committee has bitten off more than it can chew in just trying to tell this story in six or seven hearings over the course of this summer.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Garrett Graff. He's got a brand new book called Watergate, A New History. You can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in when five men tied to former President Nixon's re-election campaign tried to bug the Democratic National Committee headquarters. We're talking with Garrett Graff about the current hearings going on today, certainly what happened 50 years ago and the hearings that followed the break-in in the summer of 1973. Garrett, you said something right before the break about the current committee and the House hearings looking into the insurrection. You're concerned that they may have bit off more than they can chew. What do you mean by that?
This is a complex story. There are a lot of characters. There are a lot of facts that need to get into the record. And I do worry that they are trying to cram too much into too few hearings in order to break through to the American people. Some of the power of the Watergate hearings which existed, to be clear, in a very different media environment. You know, you're never going to be able to get the wall-to-wall coverage that was possible in the early 1970s, simply because of the depth and breadth of media choices that people have today. But that part of the power of the hearings was the consistent drumbeat and the way that people got to understand and know people like John Dean, John Ehrlichman, H.R. Haldeman, John Mitchell, and that they saw, they were able to sort of get a sense of these people and get a sense of what it was like inside the Nixon White House in a way that I worry a little bit about the ability of the committee to execute on in, you know, what is basically the same number of hearings as the first season of Tiger King.
Which had a big tune in, factor as I understand it. Well, let's go back to June 17th, 1972, of course, 50 years ago today. The burglars, they break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters. They want to bug it. They also have lots of $100 bills. What were they looking for? What, besides putting in this bugging device, what was that money about, Garrett?
Well, the money was, in their mind, to get them out of trouble if they got into trouble. They had miscalculated and thought that if they were discovered, they would be able to bribe their way past, the night watchman in the building. What they didn't factor in was that when the night watchman discovered the tape on the doorways, keeping the doors unlocked on the way up to the offices, that he actually didn't search out for the burglars himself, but just called the D.C. police. And so it was the police who ended up discovering the well-dressed burglars. What the burglars were actually up to that night is still very much an open question. We normally do shorthand it as a bugging operation. They were caught with some listening devices. Many people actually don't understand that it was the second Watergate burglary, actually, that this was the burglars were coming in for the second time to fix problems with the bugs and wiretaps that they had put in on the previous burglary. Where the open questions remain is whether the burglars were also searching for dirt, either dirt that the Democrats had on Richard Nixon, that they were sort of trying to find opposition research, or whether they were looking for evidence of Democratic dirty tricks as well. And there are a number of competing and overlapping theories about what those dirty tricks might have been, what that dirt might have been, that have consumed a lot of attention over the last 50 years.
Well, one of the things that you raise, and then I do want to get to some clips from the actual hearings, but this has come to be known as the Chenault affair, that Nixon, as a candidate, interfered in the fall of 1968 with the Paris peace talks, which were working to end the Vietnam War. You say that he sent this woman, Chenault, to essentially derail the peace talks for his own benefit so that he could win the election, which, of course, he did in 1968.
Yeah, and this is one of the things, you know, when people ask, you know, well, what new is there about Watergate? It actually turns out that over the last 50 years, and particularly over the last 10 and 15 years, as new documents and revelations have come out of a variety of archives, our understanding of what Watergate was and what the motivations were have changed pretty dramatically. And the two biggest are the revelation of Deep Throat's identity, that famous Woodward and Bernstein anonymous source who we now understand was FBI Deputy Director Mark Felt, a revelation that pretty dramatically changes our understanding of Deep Throat and his motives and sort of what was going on in the Nixon White House in the summer of 72. But then also is this Chenault affair, which was something that we didn't really understand at all, and certainly didn't understand was connected to Watergate until about 10 years ago. And it is, as you said, it's a series of revelations of documents that have come out of the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library that show that in the fall of 1968, Richard Nixon is running for president against sitting Vice President Hubert Humphrey, President Johnson is desperately trying to wind down the Vietnam War with the Paris peace talks. And Nixon and his campaign director, John Mitchell, work with this Washington doyen named Anna Chenault to stall the Paris peace talks. They send a message to the South Vietnamese government saying basically, stall the peace talks and I will give you a better deal as president than Lyndon Johnson would. And to be very clear about this, this is Richard Nixon as a private citizen keeping the war in Vietnam going, keeping American servicemen and Vietnamese dying in Vietnam for his own personal political benefit. It's some of the most serious and credible allegations approaching outright treason that we have against any modern American political figure.
But why do we, as you said, this has been, you know, in the archives for the last 10 years, but, you know, why are we just learning about this now?
Well, so what we now understand is that Johnson discovers this treachery in the final hours, the final 2 days of the presidential campaign. And he confronts Nixon. And Nixon denies the whole thing, but basically the clock runs out and Nixon wins the election closely. And President Johnson, for sort of the good of the country, in his mind, classifies the whole thing and buries it. He believes that he can't confront Nixon publicly over this treachery without undermining the moral authority of the incoming president-elect. But Richard Nixon knows that Johnson knows. And so this becomes this Edgar Allan Poe telltale heart style secret, beating away, eating away at Nixon's presidency, that becomes the thing that he most wants to keep secret in the world. And it helps drive what we now understand was his overreaction to the Pentagon Papers leaks when he actually approves a different burglary, the burglary of the Brookings Institution, the think tank in Washington, where he believes some of these Chenault affair papers are being kept. And in the summer of 1971, a full year ahead of the Watergate burglary, he orders a burglary and the White House comes up with this plan to come up with this fantastical idea of bringing in the Cuban burglars that they later use at the Watergate a year later, dress them up as a DC firefighters, equip them with a used DC fire truck, firebomb the Brookings Institution, and in the chaos, then break in and steal the vault from Brookings with these papers in it. And it's one of the wildest and weirdest criminal schemes we've ever seen in the White House, and it falls apart not because anyone recognizes its criminality, but because the Nixon White House ends up being too cheap to buy the fire truck.
God. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Garrett Graff. We're talking about his new book. It's called Watergate, A New History. He is taking us back to the time before the Watergate break-in and what led up to that break-in, which was 50 years ago today. We've got lots to cover. We do have lots of clips. I do need to just do a quick follow-up there, and I want to make sure that you can join us as well. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I don't know if there's a short answer to this question, because I've never understood why Richard Nixon sued the New York Times over the Pentagon Papers, which was about the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. It was from 1940 1945 to 1968, before Nixon was even in office. Why was he so angry about this?
It is one of the great questions, and it tells us something about Richard Nixon, which is the Pentagon paper leaks by Daniel Ellsberg in the spring of 1971 should be one of the great political triumphs of Richard Nixon's life. There are 2 million words in the Pentagon Papers, not a single one of which is Nixon. It deals entirely with his, or primarily with his two mortal political enemies, LBJ and JFK. But Nixon, on the one hand, is afraid that this is going to lead to revelations of the Chenault affair, this secret that he wants to keep. It also comes because his overreaction is driven also by this deep sense of paranoia and deep sense of secrecy that he has, and that his top aide Henry Kissinger has, that they are trying to do great things with difficult countries, including China and the Soviet Union at the time. And that if they allow these leaks, that it will spur other leaks and undermine their ability to conduct secret foreign policy. And it is that overreaction that leads to the creation of what we now know as the White House Plumbers Unit, this team of dirty tricksters who come in, G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, and others who ultimately end up also in charge of the dirty tricks portfolio for the 72 reelection campaign a year later, and are the masterminds of the Watergate burglary that then begins to unravel the whole Nixon presidency. And that is important to sort of just all put in context, that the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers, and Watergate aren't three separate events. It's actually all the same event.
Well, let me just fast forward then to the summer of 1973. We've got the Watergate hearings. As you write, and others have written as well, that this was an example of the system working. The U.S. Supreme Court allowed the tapes to be heard. The press did their job. And frankly, Congress, the legislative branch, did their job as well. And this is the famous comment by Senator Howard Baker, a Republican. This is the summer of 1973, famously asking White House Chief of Staff Haldeman a very important question. Let's give it a listen.
The one thing that keeps recurring to me, and the one thing I've tried to put to every witness that has unique information, in addition to their own personal information and knowledge, is what did the president know and when did he first know it? Now, you were closer to the president of the United States more often than probably any other person in the world outside his immediate family. Now, I want to know what you can tell me in that respect. What did the president know and when did he know it?
And Garrett, there's so many things there. One is that you have Republicans and Democrats essentially on the same team, which we don't have today.
Yes, and I think when you look at the difference between then and now, what really does stand out is that the members of Congress on both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, understood in Watergate that they had a responsibility and prerogatives as members of Congress, as members of the co-equal legislative branch, to hold the abuses of power by the executive branch in check. And that the Republicans in both the House and the Senate, and you quote Howard Baker there as well, but there were other Republicans from Lowell Weicker,
sure,
to John Rhodes to Barry Goldwater, who play their own role in this series of events, who all understood that protecting American democracy required them to exercise their responsibilities as the legislative branch before they thought of themselves as partisan Republicans. And that, to me, the list today of people who are willing to put their responsibilities as members of the legislative branch first above and beyond their responsibilities as partisan Republicans is very short, and unfortunately getting shorter. And we see that in Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger on the January 6th committee.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Jim. He says, WHYY and NPR broadcast the Watergate hearings live. I listen to them all day, and that's what made me love public radio and become a member. Thank you, Jim. I remember that as well. I know you were not alive, Garrett Graff, when all this was going on, but literally the soundtrack, wherever you went, I think in America, or certainly here in Philadelphia, you heard the hearings. Also, Tom asks, what would have happened if Nixon had had Twitter? We'll just leave that out there. But let me go back to Howard Baker's question. Do we know the answer to what did the president know and when did he know it?
Yeah, and one of the things... Part of what really stood out to me as I was working on this book and piecing together this history is how much of our, you know, understanding of Watergate as handed down to us through popular history and culture is misunderstood. That in fact, Howard Baker deployed that what did the president know and when did he know it, not as an indictment of the president at the time, but as actually a defense of the president at the time, which was there is, in fact, no evidence that Richard Nixon approved the Watergate burglary in advance or knew of it in advance, which was the point that Howard Baker was actually trying to make in that moment.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Garrett Graff. He's the author of a brand new book. It's called Watergate, A New History. And as it turns out, today is the 50th anniversary of the break-in at the Watergate. I certainly remember that time. We're also kind of toggling back and forth between the hearings during the summer of 1973 and the current hearings going on today, looking into the insurrection of January 6th. 2021. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Garrett Graff about his new book, Watergate, A New History, What We Know, What We're Learning, What We Don't Know. And Garrett, you mentioned the fact that one of the things we don't know, apparently, is who ordered the break-in at the Watergate. Let me just play a very short clip from Haldeman's audio diary, reporting that Dean said that Mitchell and Magruder had both confessed to him that they had signed off on the break-in. I want to play it and get your reaction.
Dean says he can't do what Mitchell and Magruder told him to do. The more he looks at it, the post-June activity, the more he thinks we can work that out. Mitchell and Magruder both told him that they had both signed off on the project, which Mitchell told me also.
I mean, it's not exactly a smoking gun there, but Garrett, what do you hear?
So this is one of the inconclusive and open-ended questions that we still have 50 years after the fact. The clip that you played there surfaced this week from Haldeman's audio diaries in a Washington Post article by Jim Ribeneau, who points to this as him saying that this is clear evidence that Mitchell actually did approve the burglary. I think it's a little bit more inconclusive than that, because there are really two separate sets of questions wrapped up in this. The Watergate burglary, as we've already talked about, was actually not the first Watergate burglary. It was the second Watergate burglary. And it was part of this broader set of dirty tricks that Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt had proposed throughout the 1972 campaign. And in fact, was you know, this wild and zany plan itself. Later that weekend, actually, if they had not been caught at the Watergate, that, you know, 50 years ago this weekend, their plans were to also break into George McGovern's headquarters. More broadly, the plan at one point, you know, involved everything from spy planes that would have followed McGovern around as he campaigned across the country, plans to hire call girls to lure Democratic Party officials at the Miami convention back to a houseboat wired with audio and video and photographic surveillance for blackmail and dirty tricks purposes, and even, you know, a plan at one point to kidnap and drug and hold hostage in Mexico anti-war protesters for the duration of the Republican convention to ensure that Nixon's convention actually wasn't derailed. So it was part of this much bigger operation. And I think one of the questions in that audio clip that we remain unclear about is who approved the overall operation and who specifically approved the Watergate burglary itself.
Well, and just a quick follow-up there. Nixon ordered the break-in at Brookings, correct?
He ordered the Brookings break-in in 71. So, right. You know, one of the ironies of all of this is, yes, Nixon didn't order the Watergate burglary. He ordered a different burglary. So it's not that and I think that one of the things that, you know, we do very much misunderstand is that part of the reason that Nixon couldn't come clean about the burglary at the Watergate, they couldn't just sort of write it off and cut loose these burglars in the wake of that, you know, bungled third-rate burglary, is that there were simply so many criminal schemes, so many conspiracies, so many dirty tricks underway inside the Nixon White House at the time, that sort of pulling on any one thread threatened to unravel the whole thing.
Well, let me read an email from Simone, and then we're going to play Alexander Butterfield's now famous answer to a question. But Simone says, I was working in a psychiatric hospital in the summer of 1973. We tried to watch the hearings in the day room, but we had to turn them off because they stimulated the paranoia of some of the patients. And Garrett, you talk about Nixon's paranoia and conspiratorial mind. I just wanted to, any reaction to Simone's comment there?
Yeah, and this is where, you know, I think one of the, you know, great tragedies of Watergate is that Nixon was, by almost any measure, one of the most consequential presidents of the 20th century. You know, this is a man who, you know, brought detente with the Soviet Union in the Cold War. He reopened China. He signed Title IX. He created OSHA. He created the EPA. He ended the draft. He took the U.S. off the gold standard. He, you know, ultimately wound down the Vietnam War. He brought 1,000 women into the middle management of the federal government in the first female military aides to the White House. He is the human being who was on more covers of Time magazine than anyone else. 55 covers
55
of Time magazine.
Times. Wow.
And ultimately is brought low by his inability to get out of his own way, that he you know, is so paranoid, so insecure, so secretive that even though, even as he achieves what he calls these monuments, he is always afraid that he is being undermined by his enemies, and that that desire to fight, that desire to sort of get up every day and stick it to his enemies before they stuck it to him, ends up unraveling his presidency.
Well, here here's Alexander Butterfield. He is President Nixon's deputy secretary, being asked by Fred Thompson during the Senate Watergate Committee hearings about listening devices in the Oval Office.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess, Mr. Thompson, is that the installation was made between, and this is a very rough guess, April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
Are you aware of any devices that were installed in the Executive Office Building office of the President?
Yes, sir, at that time.
Were they installed at the same time?
They were installed at the same time.
That was a bombshell in the summer of 1973, Garrett. But as you describe, here's a secretive, paranoid president who puts listening devices in the Oval Office. It's, you know, it doesn't sort of add up.
Well, until you look at it from Richard Nixon's perspective, which is he thought his presidency was going great and that he was afraid that his aides like Henry Kissinger wouldn't actually steal his historical legacy, that he sort of felt that his aides were telling him one thing behind the closed doors of the Oval Office and then saying something else publicly, and that basically that he wasn't going to get credit for his own brilliance and his own strategic genius. And so his goal was that he wanted to make sure that his aides didn't leave him holding the bag for the failures while taking credit for all of his successes. And so he installs this secret taping system because he wants to make sure that his own genius is recorded for history. And it becomes, of course, you know, the fatal flaw in the center of his presidency, and certainly leaves him a legacy, just not the one that he had wanted.
And it also underscores what John Dean had said about a cancer on the presidency and what he was telling Nixon at the time. And, you know, it's on tape.
Yes. and that becomes the whole year's final battle of the of Watergate, is as soon as Alex Butterfield makes clear that there are recordings of effectively all of the conversations about Watergate, then then Nixon begins this year-long battle for the tapes, to keep the tapes secret, ultimately losing at the Supreme Court 8-0 and forcing out the release of the tapes that show that Nixon had been a willing and enthusiastic participant in the cover-up.
It's interesting that Martha Mitchell seems to be having, you know, her moment in the sun once again. And Gregory asks, how much did Martha Mitchell know about the Watergate affair before it was public? Was the Nixon White House worried about what she could say? She, of course, was married to the Attorney General Mitchell at the time. They eventually got divorced. But nonetheless, how do you see the role of Martha Mitchell?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really tried to do in my book, and then also we've seen her portrayed in the new Starz series, this spring, Gaslit, is put Martha Mitchell back in the center of the Watergate story. Martha Mitchell is someone who has been largely written out of this story for about 40 years. She was one of the most prominent women of her age, in many ways the first conservative political pundit, this outspoken, brash mouth of the South from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, who comes to Washington and becomes this outspoken voice for the Nixon administration, sort of the person who says all of the things that Richard Nixon wishes he could say but can't because he's president. And that she is the wife of Attorney General John Mitchell. She becomes, by the spring of 72, the nation's second leading Republican speaker in the country after Nixon himself.
Wow.
And then in the hours after the Watergate burglary is discovered, she and her husband are in California. And he basically leaves her there because he knows that she will recognize that one of the burglars, James McCord, had actually been her campaign-provided bodyguard until a couple of weeks earlier. And that she would know immediately that these were people who were working on the Nixon campaign's behalf. He leaves her there to try to keep her quiet. She is she discovers eventually the burglar's identity, does exactly what he fears, and calls UPI reporter Helen Thomas. The minder that Mitchell left her with there rips the telephone from the wall, wrestles her to the ground, ends up drugging her and basically holding her captive in California for days after the burglary. And her life understandably very quickly unravels. She struggled with alcoholism and mental illness even before that. She and Mitchell divorce, and she is, you know, I think one of the most tragic figures in the entire Watergate story.
In fact, she dies a couple of years after Watergate, as I recall.
Exactly, and I think that that's not unrelated to her being written out of the story, is that there was not anyone for a long time who was, you know, tending to her history and her role in the entire scandal.
I'm looking at the clock, and I have a couple more questions for you. You mentioned Mark Felt, who was deep throat for Woodward and Bernstein. Your portrait of him is not that he was this kind of heroic truth teller, but that he was angry that he didn't get the job at the FBI that he wanted to be head of the agency.
Exactly. And this is where, again, we have long misunderstood Deep Throat because we haven't understood who he was. And what we now see and what I try to recontextualize and retell in my book is that he was this very bitter bureaucrat who thinks that he was that he had the job of FBI director stolen from him by this Nixon loyalist named Pat Gray, and makes it his personal vendetta in the summer of 72 after the burglary to try to sink Pat Gray, that he actually turns out to care very little about Richard Nixon. And there are these fascinating moments where he knows damaging information about Richard Nixon and doesn't bother to tell anyone because he actually isn't out to try to sink Richard Nixon. He's out to sink Pat Gray. And in fact, the president is effectively collateral damage in Mark Felt's campaign to take over the FBI.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, Ford pardons Nixon. Was that the right thing to do from your perspective?
I think it was. I'm actually speaking to you from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I'm at a two-day Watergate 50th anniversary event at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum. And Ford is this figure who is absolutely transformed by Watergate in the space of a year, becomes the only person never elected to the vice presidency or the presidency to hold both offices.
Right.
And, I think he in many ways does make the right decision very quickly upon assuming the presidency to pardon Richard Nixon and try to move his presidency and the country past this tumultuous and divisive moment in Watergate.
And will we ever know the full story of Watergate?
I think at this point, unfortunately, we won't, that there are too many people who have died without letting up the last few secrets.
We got to leave it there. Garrett Graff, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he is the author of this brand new book. It's called Watergate, A New History. And if you don't know by now, today does mark the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can always send us an email, then tell us what you think of the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.